Place to be, nation. We are at the finale. I would call it the finale of the podcast, which is what you're joining here. Even me being your one of your co-hosts, Andrew Reich, joined by the other co-host, Adam Murray. Adam, are there any other co-hosts I'm missing, or I pretty much got them all between you and me?
Nope. Just today, it's just you and me again for our usual NBA therapy.
Yeah, no. Yeah, none of the ones in my head. You know, that's why we need the therapy. No Todd Weber. No, you know, no Ryan Arena. No Norman Rockwell. You know, none of the special guests. It's just a mano a mano for our NBA Finals preview. That's why we call it that finale, as we always like to call it.
Just for reference, we are taping this on November 5th of 2016, right? Because
we kind of knew this would happen. that's a good kind of sound, like, starting off point for this, you know, because you know how I always like to stumble into my intros, because that's just what I do. But how much inevitability did you, not only in the playoffs as you got into it and we got from round to round and sort of became more and more obvious that Golden State and Cleveland, which are the two representatives in the NBA Finals for the third straight year, how much inevitability, not just in the playoffs, but in the preseason roundup, did you feel that this was going to be we were going to go to a third matchup?
This was 99%, I believe.
Did it ever dip anything below 90%, even throughout the regular season? Like, some doubts there, like maybe the Raptors are kind of like knocking on the door, or the Spurs seem to be playing much better, even though Duncan's retired and things like that.
No, this whole season, it just, you know, I don't want to say it was just like a soggy turd, but once Durant signed, there wasn't no like, oh, I hate him, or oh, that's great. It was just like, oh, well, there goes the season. And it's kind of been that way of, hey, we've had great storylines, we've had some great surprise superstars, some, you know, crazy trades, crazy happenings, but in the end, it's like, we know this is going to happen, so, you know, the playoffs, for the most part, were just boring, because we knew.
This is probably in my lifetime, and I'm going all the way back to, like, the early 90s when I was a kid. This might be the worst NBA playoffs I've ever seen. Would you say the same, or is there someone that maybe, like, you know, 2001 had the Lakers dominance, but I remember the Sixers having to sweat out those two series with Toronto and Milwaukee, you know, when Iverson was there, so I can't really say that one. You know, there's not really there's a couple of others that kind of made a fart noise, but I just – this one definitely, like, took the cake in terms of anticlimactic nature.
And I love how ESPN is trying to build this up as, can you believe how dominant, you know, this is the first time, you know, since whenever that the Warriors swept the series and swept everything.
We've seen close calls. I mean, I remember when, I mean, the Lakers, I already mentioned in 2001, but I mean, the Bulls and the Sonics in 96, the Sonics did go seven games with the Jazz, but they were destroying, you know, up to that point. They were like a 64-win team? And then the Bulls only lost one game, and that was to the Knicks in overtime. And then the other one that everyone mentions is the Lakers in 89, because the Lakers swept their way into the finals in 1989, but then they themselves were swept by the Pistons. The only thing that hurt the Pistons was that they had to go six games with Michael Jordan and the Bulls when Doug Collins was still the coach. So there's been other examples of this.
Yeah, but it's just like this. Did anybody expect Portland to win one game? No. Did anybody expect, you know, Utah was just happy to be there? Okay, we know they're going to get wiped out.
With no George Hill in the last two games, I believe, right?
Yeah, and then the Spurs, without their two of their three best players, well, we know it's going to be an easy run. Once Cleveland decimated Toronto, it was like, well, if Washington wins, they'd be destroyed just as easily. It's, you know, Indiana's not going to give them a challenge. Once they got through Toronto, it's like, oh, well, no other team has something. And then, you know, with the exception of that surprising, you know, the shock from Boston that one game.
Yeah, that's probably the most shocking upset win of a single game in the playoffs. Probably since I think you and I were kind of chatting back and forth about it. I'm pretty sure that Oklahoma City, when they lost at home to Dallas in the 2016 playoffs, is like, that was like a you remember that game when Raymond Felton was the leading scorer and Russell Westbrook forgot how to play defense and Kevin Durant like couldn't make a shot and they somehow lost. But then if you look at the point margin and or the scoring margin, you know, for wins by Oklahoma City was like somewhere in like the plus 18 range. It was like some ridiculous number, and it was like, how could that have possibly happened?
Yeah, so with the way the NBA was built, it's a two-team league, and you know everybody's criticizing it, but this is what people, this is what we've all built up to. So
there's not a lot of retcon, because you know we obviously took a 1 week divot here, because we, as we were watching the conference finals, we quickly realized, okay, there's really not much to discuss here. We're going to have to wait another week to kind of like load up the load the magazines up so that we could like really, you know, so that we could do this finals preview. And then it obviously we had a little they had a bit of a snag there with Boston winning game three. You know, everyone's thinking sweep, and all of a sudden you're thinking, oh, maybe a Boston has a puncher's chance. Again, game four, Cleveland wins, and then game five was just, you know, a bloodletting. But let's do a quick retcon. Let's start with Warriors Spurs. Kawhi Leonard's ankle injury. First of all, Zaza Pachulia, dirty or not?
There's been dirtier.
But I mean the second slide under the feet. You know, when he's at the corner and he can't really land anywhere else.
But everybody does that. Everybody, mm-hmm. You know, name me like all these players who stop and okay, then no, they keep walking because they don't know where the body is. So okay, I'm just gonna take another step here quietly. They're not doing it. They're not doing it maliciously. Like I'm gonna purposely put my foot because I know where he's going to land. So I'm gonna make sure. No, it wasn't as dirty as as Warriors try to make it out to be.
Yeah. Then just an absolute destruction in game two. Game three, it was pretty – it became kind of obvious early in the second half that the Spurs just weren't going to do it. They weren't going to be able to pull off that game three win to kind of keep the game – to keep the series tight. And then at 3-0, it became Manu Ginobili says his farewell because, you know, it gets a little ceremonial because you realize, okay, this is probably going to be the end. The Warriors played really – I mean, the Warriors – I mean, here's the thing. The Warriors still – had to play really well in order to win. I mean, the Spurs were so well coached that I think if the Warriors played just an overall bad game, I think the Spurs could have won one of those games even without Kawhi.
No, because as good as the Spurs were coached, you could see, to me, it looked like the Warriors are just like, all right, we could sort of just cruise along. And it wasn't, at no point was it like, okay, this is going to get close. We need to now kick it up. It just seemed like, okay, we know we're in control. Yeah, they're competitive games, but we're not, you know, again, the Spurs don't usually go score 100 points all the time. They're especially with Kawhi gone. So, yeah, they're just sort of, yeah, we know we're going to win. We know we're going to win decently. So, we're just going to cruise.
Yeah, you make a good point that the Spurs just weren't able to really slow the game down at any point. They were kind of able to do that with Houston because Houston just hit like a black hole in terms of field goal percentage. They just stopped making any of their threes in some of their critical games. Whereas with the Warriors, it was just impossible. If they're making their threes, if they're doing good ball movement without having to dribble the ball too much, it's going to be really, really hard to beat them, and the Spurs just couldn't slow them down. Let's now do the quick retcon with Cleveland versus Boston. First of all, when Isaiah Thomas went out early in game two, what was your first thought? I know you thought the series was over anyway, that they were going to get eliminated by Cleveland in quick fashion, but what was your thought when you saw that Isaiah went down?
I'm not surprised. It wasn't like, you know, a torn ACL. It was just like, oh, he's...
Did you notice anything with Isaiah before he went out?
No, not really.
No, I mean they mentioned that early in game two he was just he had no lift on a lot of his shots, and that's when they knew something was wrong.
Okay, he had no lift, he was sort of slow, but that could just be like, well, you had a grind out game seven, then the Chicago series was like they just all looked tired, they all looked sluggish, and then you know Jaylen Brown's nursing a hip injury, Amir Johnson's battling large
Amir mileage. Johnson was worthless in the series, worthless.
Yeah, he was just a ceremonial starter, and
yeah, they had to play a lot of stretch with Olynyk, unfortunately.
Olynyk and Yurebko and Gerald Green get starts, and
people thought Olynyk played well in the series because he had the one good game three, but if you look at the plus minus, he was garbage. Like he was almost unplayable against Kevin Love. So
well, everybody was. That's the problem. You can't say plus minus if Cleveland shatters every single record and you win by 40. You could. There's nobody you could put out there who would have a good plus minus, unless it's James Young, who played 2 minutes at the end.
Was there any point like around halftime of game four where you realized, okay, they might tie the series? There's a small chance.
No, you were the one that had more hope, but maybe it's just, you know, maybe it's the Saints fan in me, but I'm like, they're going to blow it. They're not going to, you know, they put all their energy into the first half. They shot their load, and it was just like, then you watched it, it was just like, okay, you could see it fall apart. And the same thing, game five, they're just like, okay, look, we're just spent. We have no energy. We're tired.
Yeah, Marcus Smart sort of kind of fell back to the mean with the field goal percentage. He had the crazy, like, irrational confidence game in game three where he just made all of his threes, it seemed like. And Avery Bradley is a fantastic player. I've always taken Avery Bradley for granted, and I need to stop doing that. He's a much better player than I thought he was. Like, now, can he be a guy that can be the lead guard of the team in case you move Isaiah and Markelle Fultz, who we'll talk about in a second after winning the draft lottery that Boston will eventually pick, and Markelle Fultz becomes, like, the starting point guard, and he has to defer to Bradley. Like, can Bradley be the man in Boston to replace Isaiah? We'll see. It might not even get to that. But it was interesting watching that backcourt between Bradley and Smart because it sort of changed the identity of how they played. The only problem is that it's not a great offensive backcourt. So the moment they stopped making shots, it was nighty-night.
Yeah, and that's basically just, you know, they can't rebound anyway, so it's just one and done. So you take a bad three up, that's your series, you know, that's your possession. So it was, you know, because realistically, how far did the average NBA fan think this Celtics would go? Oh, well, they're going to lose to Chicago after those first two horrible games. And, well, they made it to the second round. They got the monkey off their back. Well, they're definitely going to lose to Washington. Brad Stevens, you know, with the amount of overachieving he does with this team is just insane.
So you do think that Boston is not as good in terms of the sum of its parts?
Yeah.
I just love how you're like, yeah, that's like the point I just made for the last three minutes. I mean, you know?
This point I've been making all season. And even Brad Stevens knows that this team's horrible. You're 27th in rebounding. You know, what, did some teams drop out? He knows that team can't, you know, they're not built to rebound shit. And, you know, turning Al Horford into a stretch five now. Mm-hmm. Which is officially what he is. He's a full-on stretch
five.
The
one part I could not understand, I do know the team rebounding was a huge pitfall for the last two or three years with Boston, is just why did Kevin Love have so much success in the box-out scenarios with the rebounding against Boston? Like, he's always been criticized as not being a strong physical rebounder, but he seemed to really find some success with the Celtics.
Who are you against who? Jonas Jerebko, Jay Crowder, or Kelly Olynyk?
Well, you mentioned Horford, but Horford we talked about, especially in that Washington series, he kind of got put in a situation where he had to stretch out, be more of a point forward. But the thing is, it messes up your identity because you're not sitting back. You're kind of in that pick and pop scenario. You're not in the paint as much as you want to be.
Yeah, so you're not in the paint. There is no low post player on that team. You know, the closest thing to a low post player is Tyler Zeller because he doesn't have any shot outside of, you know, 15 feet. So it was just, we had mentioned, you know, like these previews, I'm like, there's no reason to make these long because it's so one-sided both ways. Boston, they did what they did. I think they're happy that they made it this far, but now, just getting back on track, Cleveland was built. Cleveland's built to beat Golden State. Golden State recruited the best guy, you know, the best player in the, you know, top three in the NBA to beat Cleveland, who is built to beat the Warriors, and only so these teams are just built against each other. And then, you know,
it's an arms race. And the thing is too, the one thing that we have that we're fortunate to have, and a lot of the other pundits are fortunate to have, is that we have direct history. Like, they've already played each other in the previous two finals. I mean, since we've started the podcast, which was in the 2014-15 season, the only finals that you and I have seen as, you know, as co-hosts is this. We haven't seen anyone except for the Cavaliers when LeBron went back to Cleveland, And the Golden State Warriors, since Steve Kerr took over as a head coach, and they started their, you know, their crazy death lineup run where it seems like no one can beat them in the West, even though Oklahoma City, as we've already talked about in 2016, came, they probably should have beaten them. But, you know, close only comes in horseshoes. Are they, you know, I do take umbrage with the comment that Golden State or that Cleveland is equipped specifically to beat Golden State. I'm not exactly sure about that. Like, I don't know if they made every single move only to beat the Warriors. I mean, I know that they have that in mind, you know, when David Griffin put the team together and they make all those smaller signings like Derek Williams and Darren Williams, who played well actually as a backup point guard. But I feel like it's just more to like stay ahead of the rest of the East so that they don't have to deal with too much of that.
But the rest of the East, there was nothing in the East to take care of. So it was, well, who are the big guns? Well, all the big guns, you know, the top, you know, six of the seven teams were out West. So, well, we need to take on the entire West. So as the West came down, okay, we narrow it down. Now it's just solely Golden State. There was no competition in the East. They didn't, you know, well, we need to get Kevin Love, oh, just to beat Toronto. No, not really.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was that small scare with Boston getting the home court of, oh, well, maybe they put them, they planted themselves a landmine. Well, it blew up on Boston, so it didn't really do much. You know, I mean, now people are literally talking about the scenario for Boston and, you know, other teams with good futures in the Eastern Conference. Like, I mean, you know, don't curse me if you have to say anything. Philadelphia, like teams that can build up down the road, where it's like, well, you got to wait for Cleveland to come down now. Like, because it's at a point where Cleveland is just so much better than the other teams in the East. But I feel like here's the funny thing about Cleveland. We've got the history, and there were very different teams, and they had different scenarios, some of which occurred in the actual finals series. So some of these things that might influence the series that we're previewing this year might be influenced by stuff that happens in the middle of it that we that are unforeseen. You know, you had the Kyrie Irving injury with the broken kneecap in game one of the 2015 finals, which basically, since Kevin Love is already out, forced LeBron James to basically go into, okay, I'm going to go into triple-double mode. I'm going to just take over every possession. It was like almost 100% iso ball, and damn near almost won the series, even though Golden State was better. Iguodala won the finals MVP. 2016, Cleveland's at full strength. They don't play well at all in those first two games in Golden State. They go to Cleveland. They get their mojo back a little bit, but Golden State steals game four. Draymond Green gets suspended in game five. Andrew Bogut gets hurt, which puts in Anderson Varejão. It's like, well, give me a description of what Anderson Varejão represented in the 2016 finals for me.
Oh, he was the Cleveland MVP.
That was a cigar. Yeah, that was like, I mean, or the Achilles heel or the Trojan horse. Like, what's a good way of putting it? It was like,
he was just the inside man.
And Festus Ezeli, who was like, we didn't even, I mean, did we realize at this point that Festus Ezeli was in the twilight of his career? Or was Golden State just so good at hiding the knee problems that we just, nobody knew about it?
Well, the Golden State was a four-man team. It was, we've seen Harrison Barnes can be good. It's just, well, if you're just literally the fifth man on court, your job is just to sit there.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to run a play for you, ever. If you get points, it's because it was a garbage point or you were so wide open. Oh, hey, look, there he is. But it doesn't matter who they toss it. That's why you see, oh, look, there's just, you know, JaVale McGee. Oh, we didn't know he could still play. Well, it's because he's the fifth man. And
yeah, he's shooting 74% from the field, and people are going gaga over the numbers because 74% from the field is ungodly high. But it's like, dude, when literally every shot attempt you do is a dunk or a missed dunk, of course you're going to shoot 74%, you know?
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, it's just, next year, if we have, you know, the fourth sequel, these will be the two most expensive teams in the league. It's just, the luxury tax might change something next year, but for now, they found the loophole through Steph Curry's, you know, friendly deal, so here we are.
Yeah, and now let's just go quickly back to those previous two, because like I said, they have direct threads, even though they're very different teams in terms of makeup, especially Cleveland, because Cleveland's had some evolution throughout those two or three seasons, because the one thing I wanted to point on with, you know, your idea about Cleveland being equipped to beat the Warriors is that the one thing that sort of got added to the repertoire for Cleveland was during that 2016 finals. Like, remember when they were playing the Hawks and all of a sudden they just realized that there were this great 3-point shooting team and they were just bombing them from the 3-point line. And that was the moment I realized, oh, okay, Cleveland's found another weapon they can beat the Warriors with. And I don't know if that's exactly what did the Warriors in the 2016 finals, but it definitely helped Cleveland to get those really big runs. Remember game six in the first quarter where the Warriors just came out, what's a good term, like a little punch drunk or a little out of it, you know?
Yeah, kind of.
Draymond was off the suspension, but he wasn't really engaged. Iguodala had a back problem, and Cleveland just bum rushed him in Cleveland in that first quarter. Like, just, you know, LeBron was just playing like perfect basketball. They were up 20 in the end of the first. Golden State couldn't recover. Game sevens are different. I mean, you and I have talked about this ad nauseum about game seven in the NBA finals. You know, our generation's been very lucky. We've had three of them in the last, 7 years, you know, and then, and before that we had one in 05, and then we didn't have one before that until 1994. We've been very lucky to see three game sevens in the last 7 years in the NBA finals. Those games are not – I almost consider Game 7s in the NBA Finals to be like a complete departure of the entire series. Is that a good way of putting it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a representation of what their strengths and weaknesses are, but in terms of the pace of play, it's going to be choppy. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be physical. You got to fight for everything, and you're going to make horrible, horrible, unforeseen mistakes that you would never even – imagine doing in a regular scenario because the pressure is so hot.
And it doesn't, there's no, like, well, if we have a bad game, we can, you know, fall back to next week. It's just, no, you're done.
It's over. It's NCAA tournament mode, yeah.
You have to throw everything at the wall. So, Game 7 is its own unique beast.
Okay, but are we going to see a Game 7 as we now get forward to the 2017 NBA Finals?
I don't think so.
What do you see here? I mean, we'll just start with the straight up numbers in terms of 4-1, 4-2, 4-3, 4-0, and you just tell me what you think, and then we'll kind of go from there with this, because I do have some numbers to throw at you for the both of them.
Okay.
So what do you have?
I didn't know I was. It'll probably be a 4-1 or 4-2 Golden State. It's just the problem, you know, as much as this team is just so smug and, you know, what do you think about the playoffs being so uneven? Well, don't watch them. You know, shut the fuck up. And Draymond Green, well, nobody's talking about me, so I need to share my opinion on everything. And
yeah, they found this quote from the preseason where he said, if I get Cleveland again in the playoffs, I want to destroy them. I think that was the quote that they threw out there with Draymond Green. You know, Draymond, he's not one for being timid.
No.
I'll take Golden State in six. You know, there is the pessimist in me that is thinking sweep. But I don't know if that's going to happen with Golden State. But it's much more likely of a Golden State sweep. And they, you know, set the record, because I don't think any team has ever swept their way all the way to the title, than it would be for Cleveland. I don't think Cleveland can sweep Golden State. Like, first of all, the home court advantage is just like – it's just one thing. We saw with the Spurs, though, where you can get out on a big lead on Golden State, but their Golden State's first quarter and fourth quarter efficiency in the playoffs this year has been like unreal. Now, in the Spurs game, that wasn't the case. They got blown out in the first quarter. Fourth quarter, though, they really took it to the Spurs, and that's how they were able to keep that streak alive of the consecutive wins. The Cleveland strength has been the third quarter. They've been the best third quarter team in the entire league for the playoffs. Do you think – I mean, can you just kind of break it down like that and say, okay, whoever wins these quarters wins the game?
Well, I'm just going to give you the John Madden. Whoever wins the fourth quarter will win the game.
Well, which is – you know, that's not always the case. I mean
– that pretty much is the case. If you're ahead after the fourth quarter, you're going to win 100% of the time.
Oh, yeah. I'm talking about like if you're so far ahead at the end of the third that the fourth quarter is almost a formality.
No, right? I'm saying if you're ahead after the fourth, mm-hmm. I would – pet anything that you're going to win.
Well, unless there's a – I'm trying to think of another scenario where it's possible it's not. But let's just get to this with LeBron James. I'm just going to go through his stats here. 32 points per game in the playoffs. Now, the assists and the rebounds are actually down. The steals are up. The blocks are up. His field goal percentage is about the same. His 42% for the three-point line is actually up from the regular season, which was actually one of his best three-point shooting regular seasons. So it means he's really doing really well at the three-point line. But what has been the motivation for LeBron to get past the 30-point mark per game in these playoffs where he's averaging 40 minutes per game, not necessarily as many minutes as he was in a regular season where he was going 42 minutes per game?
And
like,
he's still going too much.
Well, what's the motivation here with the points? Like, it's working really, really well for them, obviously. They've only lost one game in the playoffs, but, like, how has he made it work? Because I remember in the previous year's playoffs, he was averaging about 24 points along with 8 rebounds and 7 assists. It was a little different. Now, finals, we'll get to that in a second about what his motivation will be, what his numbers will look like, because the numbers in the finals against the Warriors with LeBron has been just fucking ungodly. But, how has he made it work with the able to tote out that number of points, you know, as the games have gotten faster in the playoffs this year compared to the previous years with Cleveland?
He is just willing himself to do all this. He just, you know, he wants to be the greatest ever, so the only way to do that is by just taking over. And, you know, the team's like, yeah, go ahead, we don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Kyrie's not like, well, I need my stats, I need my touches. Kyrie's just like, yeah, you want to go score 40? Have at it.
Yeah, but Kyrie has been pretty great in that playoffs too. I mean, but he's the guy who's more a player of runs. Like, he's the guy, like, when he gets hot. I mean, we've seen this against Golden State in the previous finals. We obviously saw that with Boston in Game 4, where when he's hot, look out. I mean, like, he's unstoppable. Like, is he the most unstoppable offensive guard in the league in your eyes, or is that still Curry?
Well, Curry only because he could shoot it from 45 feet. They're two completely different players. You know, you could say he's unstoppable because Curry has no problem shooting it from anywhere and making it from anywhere. Kyrie will take you off the dribble. He will do everything where you have to.
Yeah, he's got the inside dribble, the outside dribble. He's got all that. He's got the crossover.
Yeah, you have to play defense on Kyrie. Steph, if he's hot, well, you just have to be in front of him because he'll just stop whenever and shoot it. He's not going to take you off the dribble. He's not going to run around any screens. He's just going to, I'm looking for my shot. Here it is. I don't care how far it is.
Okay, a big aspect of the game plan against Golden State in the previous finals that actually wound up working out well is that they were very selective on their ice, on the pick and roll, especially when they coming off of ball screens when the Warriors tried to screen for Curry. They would obviously always make sure to kind of touch him up, try to make him feel their presence defensively before he would make a decision off of the dribble, so they, you know, either try to slow down the Warriors' pace so that, you know, Curry would either keep the ball a little longer, or he would immediately pass it off to try to get away from the ice so that you could force the ball away from Curry, trying to make the other guys beat you. Now, there's obviously no Harrison Barnes this year. There's a Kevin Durant. So a little bit of a different scenario. However, the numbers for Curry have gone up in this postseason. He's averaging 28 points per game. He's had 6 assists. It seemed like he was really finding his mojo in that Spurs series. There were some points there where I was like, okay, Curry's really fleet of foot. He's like, he's kind of back to where he was in the, you know, from the previous season, not in terms of field goal percentage, but just in terms of confidence. Can the Cavaliers do that again now that you have Kevin Durant setting those screens, Kevin Durant coming off of the weak side of the ball, you know, when Curry passes it out? Like, is that something that can work now?
No, it's completely different because, as we mentioned, you know, this team is soft and all you have to do is get physical with them. Kevin Durant can't fight through screens because he's tiny. Steph Curry can't fight through screens because, well, I meant Durant is frail. Curry's tiny. They're not built to run through things, so you have to just play big and tough against them.
But the one thing that's noticeable with Golden State is that they don't do a lot of dribbles for their possessions. The court vision for the entire team is pretty great. I mean, like, they were one of the record setters in terms of assists for a team. They were the highest assist getter as a team in the playoffs at 27.8. Their rebounding is better than Cleveland's, but not by much. You know, you'd be surprised. I think it's like in the postseason, it's like 45-41, and actually Cleveland gets more offensive rebounds because we already know that Love and Tristan Thompson, who's been an unsung hero once again, even though he gets paid like a star, has been incredibly effective, like as the fourth starter for Cleveland. But when it comes to the ball movement for Golden State, is this something where they're going to be able to continue the kind of the trend that they've been able to do, or is Cleveland's defensively going to be able to pick up the slack like they did in the previous finals and really force Golden State to make some kind of unconventional adjustment?
They're going to have to make some sort of unconventional adjustment, I think. But
would that be Iguodala taking off the court and Durant guarding LeBron primarily? Would that be it?
It will just sort of have to be, you have to let, you know, LeBron scores 40 and then shut down Kyrie. Because Kevin Love, you know, has been known to disappear. You put a body on him and make him take tough shots. Kevin gets his points from being primarily open and not really, you know, having to fight through things. Just pick and pop style. So, you have to shut down. You can't, like, same thing with Golden State. Who do you shut down? Well, same thing. We'll let LeBron do it because he's going to score 40 anyways. So let's just make sure Kyrie doesn't score 30 with him.
What do you do defensively with LeBron in terms of if you're Cleveland? Do you put him on Kevin Durant or do you float him out there so that he can try to guard Draymond Green so he doesn't hurt you in those other variety of ways that Draymond Green can hurt you?
Well, LeBron will try to cover everybody.
Well, he's kind of like what they call that, the linebacker in football, the Joker? Is that what they call him? Or is that the Mike? The guy who sort of covers all ground?
I have no clue, but that's the thing is, you know, well, what do you do if you're Golden State? Well, just let J.R. Smith shoot 30 shots. If J.R. Smith is shooting 30, then nobody else is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to take 15 anyway, so I'll just keep him, you know, if he scores, you know, a little more than average, then that's fine. They can be content with that, but, you know, you have to try to lock down other things. So, and I, you know, again, adding Durant just scores, you know, well, their numbers have gone up. Well, yeah, because they're also scoring more than they ever have, because all Durant does is, you know, he's the best guy on that team.
The only dangerous part about the strategy of, okay, let's try to let LeBron do what he can and shut down maybe Kyrie Irving or try to make life miserable for – or go the opposite and try to make life miserable for LeBron, try to have him pass off the ball, let the other guys beat us. Here's the other problem though, and you notice this in the Boston series, I would bet. The other guys can beat you because the court vision for LeBron is so good that he can just find guys literally at the very best possible spots. And if you're looking at the three-point field goal percentage and the number of three-pointers made per game for Cleveland, it's like – it's astounding. Like Kyrie Irving is like going over 2 3-pointers a game. He's like right below 40%. Kevin Love is at 47%, nearly 3 3-pointers made a game. J.R. Smith is draining him. Channing Frye's always been a good 3-point shooter, so that's not a surprise that he's at 54%. Kyle Korver, you know his game. Darren Williams, he's actually shooting 54% from the field and 50% from three. And even Iman Shumpert's at 47% from three. So these are just guys that you just can't, okay, let's lazy up here, do a double on Kyrie or LeBron, leave this guy open. It's not going to hurt us. Yes. Yes, it will hurt you.
Well, it's not going to hurt you, but again, it's just J.R. Smith. J.R. Smith does not know how to pass. He doesn't know, like I said, if you're going to have somebody who's going to, well, we could slack off somebody, but why not be him?
But that's the problem though. J.R. Smith can hurt you. We've seen it. We've seen it where all of a sudden he'll get three or four 3-pointers made in a row, and you're like, oh shit, we totally forgot about him in the game.
Yeah, but would you rather have him or would you rather have Kyrie?
I mean, I get your point there. You know, the thing is though with Kyrie, it's you're expecting it. You know what's going to happen. You almost have to like segment that into your game plan of, okay, Kyrie's going to get like 5 3-pointers. He's going to get about 25 points. You know, we got to find a way to sort of slow down the other guys. I'm not saying to just go one on, because if you do one on one on a switch with Kyrie Irving, you're dead. Because Cleveland's smart enough that they're going to set up a screen with a bigger guy or a smaller guy to cover Kyrie, or Curry to guard Kyrie, when I meant smaller, because he's the only guy who's smaller than Kyrie that's in the series. And Kyrie will just go to town on him. We've already seen that in the previous finals. But with LeBron, you cannot – I mean, it's the million-dollar question. It's more than a million-dollar question. Like, what do you do with LeBron when Cleveland sets up those screens? Do you double? Do you just bring one guy over? Do you hedge? I mean, like, what do you do there?
again, it's the question is for both teams, how do you stop this guy? How do you stop that guy? Really, the only thing you could sort of do for Golden State is to, you know, I guess I don't want to say make Kevin Love beat you and make Kevin Love take all those shots, because he's probably the weakest, you know, obviously he's the weakest of the three.
He had a very bad series in the finals last year until game 7 when he was getting all those rebounds.
Yeah, like we said, he's better open, so if you make him sort of work for it. And Cleveland, your thing is, well, get Draymond in foul trouble, get under his skin where he's going to do a stupid, dirty play.
And I'll say this for LeBron, he's the only guy that can get under Draymond's skin. Because it's the only guy that Draymond can't crack. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Which is true. I mean, that's the first time I've ever seen Draymond get like – well, he gets emotionally frustrated a lot. But where he was literally at a point where it's like, there's nothing I can do with this guy. This guy's in my head. That happened in the finals last year with Draymond Green.
Yeah, so all you could do is just get under his skin. You get him out of the game. Who's the backup on that team? There is no bench for Golden State, really. David West, you know, come on. So
David West has played well in the playoffs. You know, he's at 57% from the field.
Oh yeah, it's not hard
Patrick,
to play.
Patrick McCaw has started a few games now. Patrick McCaw gets stuck due to foul trouble guarding LeBron James. That is a white flag. I mean, that's like, I mean, you're in really big trouble in that point. I mean, you can't let that happen. It's got to be either Iguodala, who's got the knee problem. So how do you feel about Iguodala in this series? I mean, I don't want to say far removed, but we're pretty far removed from the 2015 Finals MVP, Andre Iguodala. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and like we mentioned, this is the same problem last year. The starters are going to have to play a ton of minutes. And they're going to have to even play more so this year because you can't go to anybody on your bench. Livingston's only good for a short amount of time. Outside of Iguodala,
yeah, he's
who are you
really
go to?
Yeah, just to cut. Sorry to cut you off, but Livingston has really dipped. He's at like 4 points, like just under 3 rebounds, and like less than 2 assists a game in the playoffs. I mean, he is just not. He's not done much at all.
Yeah, and outside of Iguodala, you have, you know, McGee can he'll come in for Pachulia. That's just a one-for-one swap. You can't play him anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, again, you just have to hope on David West has something in the tank for his, you know, second ring run that, you know, San Antonio failed last year, so.
The one thing that Golden State has struggled with is that they don't drive the ball a lot. Now, I know Kevin Durant is, like, one of the best on God's green earth at driving to the basket and drawing fouls. But with LeBron and Cleveland, I mean, the one thing that's always been sort of criticized that they're one of the highest percentage teams in terms of ISO, you know. And let me say this. If I have LeBron James and Kyrie Irving, I'm going ISO a lot too. I can't really blame them too much. But, I mean, this is something where – is this sort of a polar opposite type of scenario where LeBron – like Cleveland's a team that even though they do the kick out, they do like to drive and they do like to put the ball in their players' hands where they can flatten the court just a little bit or spread it out, you know, with 4 out and then LeBron just goes to work inside, or and then the Warriors, they don't drive. They kind of one of those teams that they always kind of like do perimeter ball movement type of stuff. Are they that different, or do you feel like the 3-point shooting sort of kind of goes back to their rhythm and it's able to what I'm trying to say is it's easier to sort of match up their styles because of 3-point shooting, or are their styles very different on offense?
No, it's just straight rhythm. You sort of got you hit the nail on the head with that one. Once you get in the rhythm, why bother to, you know, just go with what you do? And if it's just like, you know,
do the Cavaliers have good ball movement in your eyes when you were watching them against Boston? Did it feel like, I mean, I'm not trying to say there's lack of harmony, because there's not, definitely not. LeBron's a tremendous leader, but you know, even the Miami Heat, they seemed really, really choppy on offense every now and then when LeBron was at the lead there with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh. But does it feel like sometimes when you were watching Cleveland that you were saying, man, this is a really fluid, well-run team?
No, it's just LeBron's team. When LeBron wants to will himself to do everything, there's zero ball movement because LeBron will pass to you when LeBron's ready to pass to you.
But he can conjure up those powers at any time.
And that's the thing, is that if he wants to be deferral, like the game 3 where he's like, well, he's not feeling it, he's not hitting his shots well, he'll just pass the ball away. And the same thing at the early Cleveland game. If he doesn't want it, he'll get the ball and then immediately pass it. You just have to wait for LeBron to decide what he wants to do. The movement all goes through him.
Yeah.
And there is no move, you know, there's no movement period if it has to go back to one central thing.
That primary facilitator for Golden State, in the best sense of the word, even though Curry's assist numbers have been really good and he's been a pretty good playmaker when he's the main ball handler at the one. But the main facilitator, if you look at the numbers, is Draymond Green. Now, is there what sort of point of attack do you have for Green? I mean, you know, we already talked about the idea of LeBron kind of floating so he can guard Durant and Draymond, be selective so that you don't get caught with your hand in the cookie jar too many times with a weaker player on the primary offensive weapon. But for Draymond, like what would you think would be sort of the most conventional matchup for him? I mean, it's hard because you got Durant and you got Curry at the guard spot sort of taking up your backcourt, and then you have to bring the wings in to help out on guarding Curry so that they don't – I mean, like I said, they don't drive much, but you got to be able to, you know, get back on closeouts, especially with those corner threes that they love so much. So you're sort of stretching yourself out, and then it kind of leaves you with the one-on-one with Curry. I mean, do you put Tristan Thompson on him? You put Kevin Love on him?
I guess you have to sort of put Tristan Thompson and just have him just muscle up on him and make sure he just stays out of – the low post.
Forced a small ball five. This is one of the very few situations where you want the Warriors to go into the death lineup, which is their small ball five lineup. You know, which is because Draymond plays a small ball five, but if you got Tristan Thompson there to balance out the rebounding, that actually works in your favor. Even though, I mean, how do you feel about Thompson defensively? Do you feel like he's a tremendous player, a good player?
He's a niche player. He's just rebounding, and that's, one-dimensional.
Very active player. I'll say that for Tristan. And I always took that for granted, too, until the finals last year, where I didn't realize how active of a front court player he was until I really saw him in action. I was like, okay.
Well, it's the Tyson Chandler. As long as you have great feet and great lateral movement, it's not a slow big. He doesn't do anything on the offense, but he's not required to do anything on the offense. He's just required to sit there, be the anchor on defense. That's it.
Is it fair to call this just the rubber match of a trilogy? Like, say, for example, they don't play in the finals again. Is it fair to say the winner of this one was the better team in the overall?
No, because you added Durant. So, how good does that say on for Steph, you need to add your best buddy who's better than you.
So you're not a fan of the lineage type of storyline that's being thrown out there for these finals of, this is the part three of a three part saga between the Cavaliers and the Warriors because of Durant changing the whole.
He literally changed the whole dynamic. What did Cleveland do? They just added bench players.
Yes.
Well, what did Golden State do? Well, you added somebody who was better than any of you. Cleveland
fired up offensively. That's the one thing you can say about them. But I don't know if that's enough to overcome the addition of Durant, along with all the other things that Golden State has done well before Durant even got there. That's kind of like the bare bones of this preview at the end of the day. And the NBA Finals in general is that, can they overcome that? Kevin Durant is one of the three best players on the planet? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's why it's sort of, you can't add that to the storyline when, that's like saying, well, how did, what do you think of Fast and Furious? What do you add the Rockets in, whatever, 5 or 6? Well, that changed the whole series when you add somebody who's bigger than everything. You bring in a big-name star, well, your series wasn't the show that it once was. You brought in somebody.
Yeah. You remember True Detective? Where it's like, we're going to get Colin Farrell and Rachel McAdams and Vince Vaughn, and it's going to be this great – season 2 is going to be just as good as season 1. Well, not so much. Totally different,
It's like this. You have the NWO. You had Hall and Nash. And then all of a sudden, let's bring in Hogan. Well, then now you're no longer the NWO. You're now something completely different because Hulk Hogan is bigger than both you guys combined.
Well, the NWO thing is always a great corollary because anytime there's a quote unquote heel turn, or when a team signs, when a guy signs away from his team he's been affiliated with as like a goody two shoes, he's immediately the heel. He's the bad guy. Are the Warriors the bad guys of the NBA? I know LeBron gets a lot of shit for being sort of a control freak in Cleveland. He's still considered the guy who got David Blatt fired, even though at the end of the day it really worked in his favor. But do you feel like there's a true heel or bad guy, a villain in this scenario between Golden State and Cleveland?
No, it's bad guys in as in 1980s, teen ski drama where, Golden State is just like the Harvard boys. You're like, oh, well, we're better than you. We pay the most money. We have all this. Look at us. Ha ha ha. And, Cleveland, okay, LeBron, well, you need to get all your friends together to beat everybody in Miami. Okay, well, you couldn't win in Cleveland unless you got Kevin Love and got that third piece. It's, the same thing. It's just, well, nobody now can win a title on their own. You need now to play, build up your super team against another super team
And
at the
it,
expense of everybody else.
but does Cleveland feel like a super team? It feels like a team that's, I mean, when they assembled it in 2014, it felt like they could be, especially when they got Love in the trade with when they had Andrew Wiggins and they traded also Anthony Bennett, the other oh God, the other number one pick. But the other the, but does it didn't feel like, oh, this is a super team. It felt like, okay, this might take a little while. Even, I mean, LeBron even wrote that in that little piece when he announced he was going back to them, like, this might take a while, even though it didn't really take that long to get back to the finals. He went back exactly like the very next season, but it didn't feel like a super team. Now it kind of does, but it feels like something that LeBron sort of built,
Well, it's a super team because it was Kevin Love, and you can make the arguments. Would they have been better with Wiggins and whoever else they got?
Yeah, but
Well,
what I'm saying is
probably.
that they didn't make another addition down the road that made them like what the Warriors are. The Warriors were already a 73-9 team who set the record for regular season wins, and they were like a quarter away from winning a second NBA championship. And they had Kevin Durant. It's like, okay, this is ridiculous. Now we're getting to a point where it's like, oh, is it even worth it to even watch the season, like you're saying?
Yeah, and that's like I said, what's going to happen next year when we see Golden State obviously poised to be in the con they're already we could just pr put a hard pencil in for them for the conference finals for next year.
Yeah, I would have to say that the same way for both. So, just to wrap up, you had the Warriors in either five or six. I've got the Warriors in six.
Yeah, it's just one of those, well, do you see, I was like, do I really see Golden State winning at Cleveland for game, to wrap it up? And it's just like, yeah, that's why I'm like probably five, but
Did the Boston loss give you any pause of thinking, well, Cleveland could drop that game three, that they can be beaten at home? Because they've been incredible at home for the entire playoffs, really.
no, the same way Golden State could be beaten at home too.
Well,
It's
yeah, the Spurs almost had them. I mean, they did,
Yeah, it's just one of those, I don't think home court is as much as I don't want to say it used to be with all these super teams, because it's not like, well, oh yeah, home court matters. Well, for whom? If all these teams are coming, if you're just playing, if you're beating on shitty teams, which the playoffs essentially have been, it's not, you're not having super close matchups anyways.
Okay.
And what is LeBron going to do at home versus on the road? He doesn't play any different. He doesn't really feed off any crowd energy.
No, in fact, he feeds off hate. And I think that started in Miami, where it's like, "Oh, you want the whole building to boo against me? Well, I'll just stick it to you too." And then he plays even better.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with the series last year, where it's like, "Oh, you think I'm done, huh? Well, I'll show you." And then Kyrie played great also, but LeBron was like ungodly in those last three games. It was probably the best individual performance through three games in an NBA Finals I've ever seen. I mean, and I've seen a ton. I've seen Michael, I've seen Shaq when he was with the Lakers. I've seen a lot of great performances. Dwayne Wade in
I've seen
06.
Shaq with the Lakers. I've seen Shaq with the Heat. I've seen Shaq with
No,
the
I
Cavaliers.
Dwayne Wade with the Heat. Dwayne Wade with the Heat was on like ungodly against the Mavericks. He was unstoppable. He was literally like living at the free throw line. He was getting the free throw line even when he didn't deserve it. That's the phantom foul on Dirk Nowitzki where he clearly didn't foul him, but yeah, now we're really like going off track. But just to kind of finish it, like we have a few news and notes that have kind of popped up in the last couple of weeks. A lot of them sort of related to GM roles and stuff. We had heard all the rumors about David Griffin, who's the GM of the Cavaliers, sort of being courted by the Magic. Now the Milwaukee Bucks, now that John Hammond has left as the GM there, even though they already have a Justin Zanuck, who I believe is the team president. So the reason why you would need another GM to come in and take that part, I don't know why David Griffin would do it. But Orlando, they finally made a decision. They brought in what was his name last name? His name was Weltman or Feltman? He had been associated with the he was the GM for the Toronto Raptors for one season, even though he was in the organization for a little while, and he worked with John Hammond in Milwaukee. Well, Hammond is also going to Orlando, but he's gonna be the GM underneath his previous like his underling in Milwaukee because he's now the team president.
Yeah, it's all these weird subtitles they've all of a sudden come up with now. And, well, you're the GM, but you're the president, and you're co this, and you're, in training for that. And very,
That's
very strange.
the name of the guy is Jeff Weltman, and he had been the GM for the Toronto Raptors. He had just gotten promoted that position over the summer. He worked under obviously under Masai Ujiri. Now he's going to be running the Magic. John Hammond is in there as the GM. Now we've also gotten some word with the Atlanta Hawks that they're bringing in the an assistant general manager with the Golden State Warriors, Travis Schlenk. And that will be the new team president, I believe, or the new general manager for the Atlanta Hawks. So, I mean, we don't really know much. I mean, we already knew Wes Wilcox was out. It's just kind of scary to think that the Hawks are already thinking. Here's what I don't. I mean, we'll get to this when we do the offseason stuff. But the thing that scares me about the Hawks is last year you made a bunch of changes already. You signed Dwight Howard, you left Al Horford walk, you let Jeff Teague go. You made all these changes. When you replace the GM, that's a sounding board by the owner of we want to make wholesale changes. So you want to make wholesale changes 2 years in a row, and you want to keep the coach with all that scrutiny?
Well,
Not
I think
really create a toxic environment.
the shock was that Budenholzer wasn't the GM. And like we mentioned, the Budenholzer coach and Budenholzer GM were, two different people, and one was overwhelmed and one, they didn't really make the best, choices in let's get Howard. They tried to patch it up, and we had mentioned this team got old, and then once Toronto picked Damari Carroll, well, then your whole five lineup sort of fell apart. And well, now what can you do? Who's this? And you have Teague versus Schroeder, and you had this sort of patchwork deal, and we know they couldn't keep up that one season they had 3 years ago. And all of a sudden, piece by piece, well, now they're getting older, and they're getting older. Well, you
Yeah,
marginalize Hortford by getting Dwight
you
Howard.
dump Korver, get some draft picks out of it. You start playing guys like Torian Prince and DeAndre Bembry more. You gotta kind of start from the ground up with the draft picks that you made. And that, what kind of hurt them is that their success came back to get them because they were dumping their draft picks, not thinking they were going to be good that quickly. So they were trying to like add pieces to the nucleus that they had that won the 60 games, and it turned out to be a misnomer. Like it was
Oh,
like,
yeah.
don't build on something that's got a shaky foundation,
It was just, it was a, you had lightning in the bottle. It's like, no, we can recapture this. And, like we both sort of mentioned is, what was your goal with, we have Howard, we're going to get Hortford and Millsap. You can't play all three together. What was your end game with that? Everybody's going to plateau and play 30 minutes? I don't think that's going to make everybody happy. It was a very just strange move. And then, yeah, like we said, okay, you thought, well, this is something we can sustain, and everyone's like, no, not really, but you bought into it, and it just, it was short-sighted on their part.
And yeah, so it'll be interesting what the Hawks do. The last one we'll talk about that we didn't discuss because it happened in the middle of our 2 week, our typical 2 week sabbatical, was that the NBA draft lottery took place. Your Boston Celtics won the number one pick. The Lakers were able to keep theirs at number two. A lot of intriguing stuff with the Kings, where they were actually going to get a higher pick, but Philly had the right to swap thanks to that salary dump deal they made in 2015. So the Sixers kind of saved their hide with that one. The Kings did win out, though, by being able to keep their lottery picks. The Pelicans didn't move into the top three, so they got the pick that they got in the DeMarcus Cousins trade. Was there anyone? Do you remember anybody who like really lost out in that scenario? I can't really remember off the top of my head because there were so many teams involved in all the web of trades and intrigue with the NBA draft lottery. I'm trying to remember. There was like a true loser. Like it may have been the Phoenix Suns because they weren't in the top three.
You say the Suns, you could say Phoenix. Philly because they didn't get all their picks. They didn't get number one.
Yeah, the Knicks. Well, not only that, they're number three in a draft where point guard, which is their biggest need, the top two are going to probably be gone by then. You know, would you call the Lakers a winner? You know where I'm going with this.
The Lakers,
because they get the number one, number two pick, but now you're right on the beeline for Lonzo Ball and his obnoxious, you know, outlandish dad.
You know who? I'm not going to comment on that because I'm tired of that. But
I found great troll bait for Adam Murray for future episodes. I need to keep
just right now. But the problem with the Lakers is their fans are now delusional again and think, well, we could keep the number two pick. We could keep Ingram. Somebody's going to take Mozgov and Luol Deng off our hands.
Not Mozgov.
No, we could get Paul George and give up absolutely nothing for him. Well, why wouldn't they take Larry Nance and Mozgov and Deng? Like, that's the problem, is they have this irrational, you know, we'll talk about this in the previews. How are Ball and D'Angelo Russell going to play together? You know, it's a lot of money.
Because Russell would have to play off ball too, but you know, it's funny because his scouting report was that he had great court vision. Well, that hasn't shown in the NBA. He's more of a gunner. So, you know, Lonzo, I mean, that is his number one. Like, he's really great. I mean, we'll talk about this in the draft previews and the team previews, all that jazz. But, like, I think Lonzo's a transcendent player. You know, I think he could be a player that can literally change your team overnight. I don't know how good he can be at his best, but I think when he's at his best, the rest of the team is much better. Now,
you see, the thing with him is, as I've mentioned numerous times, his little funky shot I don't think is going to work in the NBA.
Well, not just that, the point of release will kind of like trap him, because obviously defensively, we might even see that in summer league if Lonzo even lets him play, which I think is doubtful because he's so stuck up, he'll think that he's just too good for summer league. But they'll just trap him in different dribble drives where they force him to go I believe right, cuz doesn't the ball come out of off of his left side? So they'll just force him to go right so that he can't get his shot off. You know, you know, like different things like that. But we'll see if they can make the adjustments. You know, we remember when Tim Tebow tried to change his release because everybody was scared about his release not working and all this stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
It's one of those things. It's one thing to work against, you know, Oregon State and, you know, Arizona State. It's another thing when you have to go against Chris Paul, you have to go against.
Well, he went up against Markelle Fultz. I know Washington was garbage, but they did. I mean, he played some good talent in the Pac-12.
You play a handful of games, whereas the NBA, you have to play against even just, let's say, the garbage like Patrick Beverley, who only plays defense and is going to be sitting there, you know, up on you trying to swat the ball. And it's a lot different.
Yeah, and I mean, where was your excitement factor with Boston? I called you. I think you were in a slumber when I let you know about the draft lottery because you were taking a cat nap. And you were,
I was busy in my nap time as usual, they're gonna get fourth. You're like, nope, they got one. I'm like, that's strange. And I'm like, well, this is what, you know. I'm like, the conspiracy theory would be if the NBA. I'll put it this way: the NBA wants big market teams to have the stars. The worst thing that could have happened is if Phoenix and Minnesota won. Mm-hmm. Where nobody's going to watch those games.
Well, you and I both know from the history of the draft lottery and the NBA draft before the lottery even happened, when Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the Phoenix Suns, remember they lost a coin toss and the Bucks won it? The Suns never come out roses and sunshine when it comes to the NBA draft. They always get the shitty end of the stick. The Kings, too. They just have that history of never winning out when it comes to the top pick.
Yeah, and if they won the top pick, nobody would stay up late to watch these games. And that's, we saw that with Durant and Odin. Hey, this is our most big marketable stars we've had in, you know, we're coming off LeBron and a couple years ago. This is huge. These are two guys. This is 1 and 1A again. Oh, well, they're both on the West Coast, so we're not going to stay up for that.
Mm-hmm. And there's so many scenarios with Boston. I don't even want to talk about it because it would start a giant rabbit hole discussion. There's just so much stuff there. We'll get to that when we do our Eastern Conference playlist, which might be the next one, hopefully, Adam, right?
Well, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I don't know. So,
are we announced? We've already announced it before on the show, right?
Oh yeah, we've noticed it numerous times, but
That Adam's wife is very close to delivering a child, so there might be a chance that we might have to skip a week as the finals go on. But it's not like too many other games are going on. You know what I'm saying?
next episode is TBD, but we'll be back for the we know at least we'll be back for the for our
What are you more
upcoming.
excited about, the NBA finals or the child coming? I would have to think it's the child.
I'm not excited for the NBA Finals at all because we were preconditioned to expect it. So
Well, you're
we knew
pre,
this was coming.
but that's the thing though. You're preconditioned to expect a child coming in. You got 9 months to like hype it up.
But you have to hype up. This was just there was no hype because of the Durant thing. But just to wrap up the draft thing, getting the number one pick is great and all. But let's just think back to 2013 when the Cleveland had no clue what they were doing and picked Anthony Bennett.
Yeah, but they were bad. I mean, Cleveland was really, really bad at the time. Even in 2014,
So,
they were bad.
but winning the first pick and winning the lottery, getting moving up to top three doesn't always look at Hasheem Thabeet in Memphis with the
Oh
number two.
man, you just name dropped one right there. I'm
You
trying.
know, Darko having you know
Darko
having.
Milicic is like one of the greatest missed opportunities in draft history, especially with a preconditioned NBA Finals contending team in
You know,
Detroit. Yeah.
moving up in the lottery doesn't mean anything. We could just go off on, Ekpe Udoh's and Alexei Yaroslavl's and Joe Alexander's. Just you have a top 10 pick, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a good
I'm
player.
trying to think of some of the. I mean, Adam Morrison with Charlotte. Where was that? Number three? Number
Number
five?
three.
Yeah. Wow. But yeah, just to kind of finish up. A lot of excitement, a lot of anticipation in the air, both on the court, off the court, on the Skype, off the Skype. A lot of stuff going on, but hopefully we sort of like. We're able to give you as good of an overview as possible for this NBA Finals. It's not like we weren't seeing it coming, like Adam was alluding to, but you always have to kind of get into the. Yeah, I mean, you have to bite the sandwich if you want to get the meat. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you got to talk about something. I mean, at the end of the day, it feels like a lot of inevitability, but there's some things there that might be interesting. I mean, would you be shocked if Cleveland was up 3 games to 1?
No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't, because again, we spent the whole literally 45 minutes saying how will A stop B? Well, how can B stop A?
Can the war maybe
So,
the Warriors will go 3-0 and blow it so that they can overtake the Warriors blew a 3-1 lead mean. I mean, they got to find a way to get rid of it. I mean, will they be able to get rid of it? Like, say the Warriors win this one. Can they get rid of the Warriors blew a 3-1 meme? Will it go away?
no. Not really. It's not. It sort of went away
Like,
already.
for example, if the Falcons win the Super Bowl, will anyone ever forget that they blew a 28-3 lead? I'll never forget that because I hate the Falcons.
Well, that's why people still bring back. Hey, remember in the 70s when Terry Bradshaw did this? No.
I never told you that, being that you're in Massachusetts, and I know you're a Saints fan, but like being in Massachusetts, I never thanked you for that one. I was like, for the Patriots and the Falcons, I should have just told you I owe you one. So, oh, I hate those people. But no, let's see if I mean we've had a really great streak of tremendous championship competitions, I guess, because summer series and summer games kind of got stopped in North Carolina and Gonzaga. That made a fart noise. Hopefully that doesn't do it in this case, but maybe we're in that lull again in championship history. But on behalf of Adam Murray, Sandra Reach, enjoy the NBA Finals. We'll see you again.